Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party. On today's episode, we are paying another visit to Room 101. I'm your co-host, Alice King, and with me is the David Baddiel to my Frank Skinner. It's co-host Lee Hutchison. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. It's been, I think I was trying to think like, oh, when did we last do our last episode of Room 101? It feels like only yesterday, but in reality, it was actually like 35 episodes ago. It feels like we've been really productive this year.
Indeed, yeah. It was just before the Edinburgh Film Festival.
That's right, yeah.
So it was a few months ago in episode 102. So if anyone wants to catch our first visit to Room 101, you can check out episode 102 of Filibuster. But before we pay a visit to Room 101 again, let's just have a quick catch-up on what we've both been watching this week. So what have you been getting into your eyeballs this week?
Yeah, it's been quite a busy week, really. It's been a kind of mix of it seems like some of these movies that have kind of been a bit hyped up in the past kind of few weeks, kind of coming from America, things like A Simple Favor and Crazy Rich Asians have kind of finally landed here in the UK. So I managed to see both of them, and I went along to see Climax, which is incredibly hard to find in cinemas at the moment. It seems to be one cinema, one or two times a day to see that. And I went to see the MIA documentary, which was quite incredible. So yeah, it's been quite a good week. I don't know if you've seen any of those ones.
I've seen a couple of those. We haven't, sadly, we've been unable to climax up here in Aberdeen.
Right.
Maybe we will at some point in the future, but who knows. I've managed to catch the Henry Golding double bill, as it was.
Yeah, I know. I didn't expect that. I watched Crazy Rich Asians second, and I went to Joe. It's like, hey, yeah. The guy looks like the spit image of the boyfriend from the last movie. And then it was just like, teasing, it was like going, ah, it's definitely that guy.
Yeah, no, he's had quite... I think apparently these are his first two films, but it's just...
Yeah, apparently
he
used to be like
those
a travel reporter or something.
Crazy ways that the film scheduling thing works out, that they just happen to be released within a week or so of each other. But do you want to talk us through sort of Climax and the MIA documentary, and then we can get on to the ones that we've both discussed? And then the only other thing that I've watched this week was I binged Bodyguard over the weekend.
I have yet to watch that.
A bit of TV. My wife kept thinking I was watching like a feature-length TV version of The Bodyguard. I had to keep telling her that it's Bodyguard, no the in front of the end. You know, like that bit in The Social Network about Facebook, mm-hmm. Just drop the, it's just Bodyguard. So yeah, which was actually very good, actually. I got properly into it, steamrolled through like all sort of six episodes over the weekend. The ending maybe wasn't as satisfying as it could have been, but I think the problem is, I'm sure a lot of people else have sort of found this with the show, is that we're so used to shows having multiple seasons that you having everything sort of almost neatly wrapped up at the end, you're like, huh. And like there were so many other sort of plot threads that you think are going places, and then when they don't go to the places that you think they're going to, you're ever so slightly disappointed. But overall, I thought it was a cracking show and one of the best sort of things I've seen on BBC for a long time. So
it seems there's been kind of a lot of buzz about BBC TV in the past few weeks, like this Killing Eve, which I really need to get started on as well.
That's
it seems kind of like an exciting time for
I think
TV.
I'll have on my box set list as well, and I've just started Maniac as well on Netflix, which
I need to
I've watched the first episode of that, and it's piqued my interest, so I'm looking forward to doing it. But I know that Tristan and the girl have just reviewed the whole season spoiler free on Nerd Nutshell, but I'll need to hold off on listening to their latest episode until I've managed to watch it all myself, I think.
Yeah, like, so I kind of obviously spent the kind of past few weeks, I had a wee hat, it's kind of a peak of sort of running season at the moment as the season kind of wraps up, so that and films have really kind of taken up the kind of past few weeks, but these things are kind of on my schedule. But Climax has been a movie I've been kind of really looking forward to for a good few months now, since the kind of buzz came out of it. Cannes, A24 bought the distribution rights for it in America, Arrow Films were releasing it here, and it was one of those trailers, as soon as I saw it, I was immediately hooked in, the music, the visuals. And for those that haven't seen the trailer, I think you kind of almost need to go out of your way to kind of find it. It's not screening it, perhaps any of the Cineworld or Odeons, but it's about young dancers that are gathered in kind of this remote and empty school. It's snowy outside. And after having a kind of big blow-off kind of dance celebration, they start to dive into the sangria, the punch, but it's been laced with LSD, and this dance troupe find themselves succumbing to the drugs that are in their system in bizarre ways. Some of them are dancing, someone gets their head set on fire, there's incest, there's, you know, children dying. It's nuts. It's the kind of thing, obviously, with Gaspar Noé, who's directed this, it's, you kind of go in expecting a bit of shock and awe, really, something like this. And I think the first 20 minutes of it is as good as anything I've seen in the cinema this year. I mean, 10 of that minutes is pretty much a dance number where the camera just kind of floats around watching them as they just do this incredibly choreographed dance sequence. It's unbelievable. And then the kind of party starts. And I think it's one of those ones, it's hard to say if my expectations were perhaps too high for what kind of shock and awe I was going to expect. And I know I mentioned things like, you know, sexual antics and fires and children dying, and that's pretty shocking. But I maybe expected a little bit more shocking things to happen. And I think I saw someone from Little White Lies almost say, is it possible that I was overwhelmed but underwhelmed at the same time? And I've kind of got that odd sort of relationship with it where I definitely would love to see it again. It certainly was a great experience to see in the cinema, and it's like the sound design, the visuals, the choreography, it needs to be seen on a kind of a big screen in that respect.
Absolutely. That reminds me of that great quote from 10 Things I Hate About You. You could be overwhelmed, you could be underwhelmed, but can you ever just be whelmed?
I think
you can in Europe, so maybe Gaspar Noé's Climax is the first whelming film of the year. So.
Absolutely. And then I caught Matangia Maya MIA, which was a fantastic kind of documentary. I caught it last night at my local indie cinema. It seems to be another film that is only getting screened at kind of one cinema as well here in kind of Edinburgh, which is always disappointing for something like this. But it's the documentary that covers the rapper, British kind of refugee MIA, who grew up for the first sort of 10 years in Sri Lanka, then kind of moved over here as a refugee in her early years, and then she kind of found her way to becoming one of the most biggest musical stars in the world, and kind of courting controversy along the way. That, you know, I knew her songs, I've kind of danced along to them in nightclubs in my younger days, but, you know, I was a bit ignorant sort of about the Sri Lankan aspect of it. I know it's always been sort of there in her songs, but, you know, kind of knowing the full story, really, as it were, about her kind of life story, her father being sort of a rebel freedom fighter. And I'd kind of forgotten about all the controversy that she had in sort of the late 2000s, the late early 2000s, late kind of past kind of 10-15 years, where, you know, she was talking about what was going on in Sri Lanka, like the murder, the genocide that was going on, and the amount of times that she was dismissed about it, that people kind of shrugged her off. You know, people were so, you know, outraged about some of her antics, for example, that there's a brilliant scene where, you know, this film, when you sit down to watch it in a cinema, it comes up and it says 18 rated for real life death footage. And that immediately kind of throws you, like, wow, I didn't expect this in sort of like a music biopic. That's got to be a first. And, you know, you see all this horror stuff that's going on in Sri Lanka, and then it's kind of offset by some of the absurd situations she finds herself in, where she's asked to go into the Super Bowl with Madonna and Nicki Minaj, and it's like she's just released a song called Bad Girls, and she's dancing away and she kind of playfully flips off the TV camera, and like the NFL just lose their shit about this moment. And then you see her kind of in the back room after the show getting undressed, and then they're like, yeah, we want to talk to you about that flipping off thing. And then they just like sort of run away. They just like go, right, no, we're getting out of here. And like there was such a huge outrage about this behavior, and then she's like, but at the same time I'm going on and talking about like murder and genocide, no one cares, but I flip off a TV camera and everyone loses their shit about it. It was just a really good documentary. It was more focused on that Sri Lankan aspect than just a traditional music biopic. What made her the musician? It's like, what made her the person? And I really recommend it. Definitely one of the best documentaries I've seen this year.
No, it sounds fascinating, and hopefully it's kind of one. It seems like a sort of natural fit for Netflix, and because they've got a few good sort of music documentaries. But yeah, no, the NFL are very quick to throw their toys out the pram. I think it's everyone has seen over the last 12 months or so. So I'm not surprised at that. But
Janet
this
Jackson's
is
in the back
exactly,
going, "What about the past
exactly.
20 years?"
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so that leads us on to the ones that we've both seen. So Crazy Rich Asians, let's go with that one first. What did you make of it?
I really disliked it, I've got to be honest. It's one of these ones that my problems with it are kind of a bit mixed. That there's that the one aspect that I love about the film is that you have such amazing representation on screen with this cast. It's like all Asian actresses, actors. They're going out in Shanghai. It's a place that's kind of still quite mysterious, really, on screen. And I thought that's fantastic. It's great to have that representation. But at the same time, and I know I've kind of got hard. I've been trying to kind of get deal with it in my head that I almost find that like it focuses on like this. This is like the ultra 1% of the planet, the population that we're encountering as this girlfriend meets her parents, her boyfriend's family for the first time. And I was just like, became really sick and tired of seeing this like 1% lifestyle. This it almost felt like it at times it was kind of shaking a finger at it, but other times it felt like it was fetishizing it, leering at it in a kind of look at this, look at how they they live and their fancy dresses and their big homes. And it just became a bit tiring. It's like, I don't want to see this. I don't care about this. There's like, this isn't the type of representation that I want to see. Is this one rich 1%? There's enough of that. But I thought, Michelle Yeoh was just so good in this role. She has a tough one to do. She's got to be the bitch, the hard mother. But you've got to almost believe at the same time that she's got our son's best interest in heart. I was really frustrated with it. I don't know how you felt.
I think I was slightly disappointed with it as well. It had all these rave reviews sort of coming in across from America and stuff like that. Everyone was saying, oh, it's one of the best rom-coms in years, it totally revitalizes the genre. And for me, it didn't. It almost played it perhaps too safe, and it was too familiar in the beats of the genre that it tried to do. I mean, in some aspects, I can see why they wanted to do it. That it's proving that, a purely Asian cast can sort of pull off this kind of film. I mean, in an aspect, yeah, they certainly do. There was nothing wrong with any of the performances or anything. It just, I don't know, for me, it wasn't, I don't think it was crazy enough. And I think that for me, my issue with the film comes down to with is a matter on punctuation, in the fact that this is a film about crazy rich Asians, as in with no commas. However, I would have preferred it if it had been crazy comma rich Asians, and the fact they've been crazy and rich, because I thought there might have been a bit more sort of madness to it, and sort of in the schemings of how the mum wants to get rid of the prospective sort of girlfriend and stuff like this. I thought there would have been a bit more wildness to it, other than a couple of "ooh, look at our really, really rich, ultra exclusive lifestyle of having a bachelor party and a hen party on these private islands and stuff like that." It's like, yeah, and yeah, no. So for me, it was slightly underwhelmed on that one, but thankfully that was all turned around by the other Henry Golding film which I watched, which was an incredibly welcome and enjoyable surprise, and that was A Simple Favor.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. I was genuinely surprised how much I enjoyed A Simple Favor, because the trailers have sort of really been kind of non-stop the past kind of month or so, and the trailers really didn't do too much for me. I mean, I like Blake Lively, Paul Feig, his Freaks and Geeks connections will always give him attention from me, and I love Anna Kendrick, but the trailers weren't really doing much for me. I thought it was like, it's kind of, I've sort of seen something like this before, especially in terms of like Gone Girl. This just looks like a kind of bargain basement version of that. But then sort of in the past week or so, like all these good reviews were starting to come in for it, and I was like, well, it sounds like a good date movie, and that's what it kind of turned out to be. It was real enjoyable, and it was good to see Anna Kendrick getting a leading role in something that was quite delicious to watch, really. And I think, you know, there's aspects where you kind of need to, you know, have a suspension of disbelief in terms of how maybe relationships unfold quite quickly, and these sorts of things, and it's some of the tropes that we've kind of come to see from movies like this do appear, but I just found it to be so highly enjoyable. It was a good mystery. It wasn't trying to be sort of like the high end something like David Fincher does with Gone Girl. This just was like a really good fun date movie with a nice mystery, some good acting, some good humor. It just had a nice mix of everything. I sometimes I come out of a film and I think, yeah, that's definitely like a 4 or a 5 or something like that, and then usually a couple of days later it's kind of maybe come down half a star or a star, whereas this has just stayed nicely at 4 the whole time. It does what it does really, really well.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. This was, I'd seen the trailer a couple of times, and it's a difficult film to market. I think you could have marketed this potentially as a straight up comedy and then totally blindsided people with like the second half of the plot. However, I think you will get into that situation where people are then would have backlashed against it, and it would have probably got more negative reviews that way. So, but I think I managed to avoid everything apart from like the one main trailer, and I was quite intrigued by it because I enjoy Gone Girl, and this was sort of basically sort of marketed as Gossip Gone Girl because it's got Blake Lively in it, and I thought Paul Feige did a great job of skirting that way around the different tones, and because it does kind of start off like a sort of meet cute sort of comedy about two mums who find each other, one sort of very prim and proper and uptight, and the other one is swearing like a trooper and drinking a dry gin martini at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, made with her husband Ryan Reynolds' gin. He's somehow basically managed to get product placement on that, basically supplied the gin, and whatever. I don't know if they're going to go back and basically shoehorn aviation gin into every other Blake Lively movie, such as The Shallows, where she just sat on a rock having a vodka martini with a shark, but who knows. But this film was, I thought it did it very well in changing from comedy to very dark thriller on a dime, and I thought, I don't want to say too much about it because the more you sort of talk about it, the more the surprises are sort of diminished. But I thought, yeah, it does get maybe a little bit silly, but it totally fits the movie that he's going for. I mean, there's a bit sort of towards the end where, there was whoops and cheers in the audience actually that I was in. They actually really embraced the film and totally got into it. And there was a moment where you're just like, it's like that sort of huge sort of shock, but then you're sort of laughing sort of 5 seconds later at it. And I thought it was just really good. I thought Blake Lively was superb in it. I thought, I've never really seen her in a role like that. And I think this could be a huge calling card for her, and she'll probably be able to step out of Deadpool's shadow and sort of really become a huge star on her own. Because beyond sort of Gossip Girl at the moment, she hasn't really found that sort of role yet. But I mean, Anna Kendrick I thought was great as well. It sort of, She's proven herself very good at comedy, but now she's shown that she's got a darker edge as well. And I thought it was just really good. I mean, it does sort of plot reference, yeah, like sort of Gone Girl and also Les Diaboliques, the French one as well. So it knows what type of film it wants to be, and I think it executes it very, very well. And I think if audiences should try to go in to see it having read as little about it as possible, and I think they'll get the most out of it if they do.
Definitely, absolutely. I think it's good that we agree on a kind of movie like this. I think it's one, I think, go see it on a date, go see it. This is the kind of movie I think that's good for people to go see with friends. It's something original, something, I know it's adapted from a book, but it's not like a kind of franchise movie or one of these big blockbusters where everyone kind of goes along. This is the kind of movies that are really nice to have kind of sprinkled through the year.
Absolutely, and it's a great sort of return to form for Paul Feige, considering the last film he made with a sort of largely female cast was the Ghostbusters reboot, sequel, reimagining, whatever it eventually was. But I mean, I actually kind of enjoyed it, and I thought it was that it was received far too much criticism, and just because they'd basically taken a well-beloved franchise and decided to remake it with females in the lead, which I guess could easily bring me on to High Fidelity, which has just been announced as having
a... I wonder what you think.
I know, I actually said on Twitter today, I was like, because I'm a huge High Fidelity fan and a man and I'm on social media, should I be throwing my toys out of the pram and getting in a huff about this? But then I thought, you know what? Let him do it. You know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, told from a female perspective, because I think Zoe Kravitz is going to be playing the person who's obsessed, who's running a music store and is obsessed with music and decides to go and hunt down her ex-boyfriends to figure out why she can never have a longer lasting relationship. But I was saying that there's going to be people going that, oh, this is a terrible, this is going to show men in a bad light. And it's like, well, clearly you've not watched High Fidelity, because Rob Gordon is a bit of an idiot the entire film. So, you know, he says it himself, you know, he's been thinking with his guts for 14 years and he's come to the conclusions that his guts have shit for brains. So, yeah, he's not the smartest tool in the box, and he does treat the girls that he's with terribly. So, you know, he gets what's coming to him. But, you know, he's still a character which I really love, which is a lot. You know, the book is fabulous, but I just love John Cusack's interpretation on the character. And that was during his, you know, period of, you know, that when he was doing Gross Point Blank as well, where basically he was doing hit after hit after hit for me. And, you know, it's gone off the boil a bit recently, and he's done all these direct to DVD films and stuff like that, which have just been terrible. So hopefully at some point in the future he'll be able to find that role that brings him back to that kind of thing, I think.
Absolutely. I'm definitely curious to see it myself, and if people think this TV show is going to show men in a bad light, they're going to get a huge shock when they turn on the news or anything. That this week alone, it's so if you think this movie is going to turn the tide against men, I think you're kind of in a bit of a hole.
Absolutely. So I guess it's talking about things which have received sort of bad press and potential bad press, I guess it's time to move swiftly into room 101, where you can potentially consign some of those things to the doldrums and to history, where we may never speak of them again. So if people aren't familiar with the concept of room 101, you can go back and listen to episode 102, where we did it for the first time, where I was presenting my case to Lee about what I'd like to see consigned to room 101. But essentially, we've got five topics, and for each topic, Lee will be presenting his case of something that should go into room 101 that will never be spoken or heard of again. And it's up to him to convince me to push the button and consign that into room 101, or to allow it to remain roaming free in the world to annoy even more people. So our first category is looking at studio trends. So Lee, what would you like to see put into room 101?
Yeah, I'm just getting really tired. And I mean, when I was thinking of what I grew up with as like a kid, I loved Star Trek, James Bond, Batman. Still do love all those things. But like when I was younger, those things kind of felt particularly special, like, oh my god, it's like a new Star Trek movie's coming, a new Bond movie's coming, Batman, oh, it was terrible, but it might be back in 5-6 years, you know, that doesn't seem too bad. But, you know, that was kind of like my diet as a young kid. And then as I kind of became sort of a teenager, like I would discover kind of brand new movies, and like I would have those kind of options there to go see. But like it seems like now that with sort of things like kind of Fox Searchlight now going to Disney and a lot of these kind of current trends, I'm getting really tired of kind of studios now freaking out and just betting down on franchises. And that, you know, we talk about certain movies like Eighth Grade, for example, which I'm still waiting on a UK release for. Like, I feel like kind of studios, like the big ones, you know, the Disneys, everyone, they're not making much in the way of new and original movies. Like when we talk about something like A Simple Favor, like we're really excited that there's like a big kind of studio movie, you know, well, a studio movie that they've released something like this, and it's a bit of a surprise. It came out kind of a bit of nowhere, but they've released this. Like movies like A Simple Favor, for example, and numerous others should be as equal parts of kind of the schedules as anything else, whereas now it just feels like studios are shoving franchises in it every week. That, you know, you only have to look back at April. We had Black Panther pretty much finished its run at the cinema, to then have the Avengers, to then, while Avengers is only like a few weeks old, we have something like Solo getting kind of dumped into the ground. And then, you know, like Christmas time, I think it's like on the same day that we have Aquaman, Mary Poppins, numerous other kind of films. I can't remember one that came out yesterday, there was a trailer for that. Like that all comes out on the same day, and it's like, it's too much. Like there needs to be sort of like, everything's excess, everything's a big studio, everything's sequels, soft reboots, franchises. Where are the original movies at a Christmas time from a big studio where it's like, hey, this is going to be our Home Alone, this is going to be our Die Hard? Like it doesn't seem to be that way now. It's just Star Wars every Christmas apart from this one forthcoming. But if you know what I mean, it's just where the studio's taking a gamble on something, putting something new in, you know, at least every kind of week, every second week, it just seems like it's getting all too rare, and something like Simple Favor is what we end up with.
No, I can see your point. Yeah, so you would like to see the end of franchises on the studio calendar, and because absolutely, I think there does need to be a greater sort of reliability on original content and original films and smaller budget films. I know someone had written an article for The Guardian recently where it was basically saying, are we looking at the end of original films? Is the cinematic calendar just going to be superhero movies? And I was like, well, no, don't be stupid. You know, the cinema exhibition industry cannot survive on 6 superhero films a year. You know, you can't fill 52 weeks with 6 films over 10 screens, you know, 20 times a day. It's just not going to happen. So you do need those other films, because for every, you need a sleeper hit to suddenly, you know, because, you know, if you put all your money in one large solo size basket and it doesn't pay off, then, you know, you're in a lot of trouble. So absolutely, I think there needs to be a much greater sort of responsibility for creating sort of other, you know, small budget independent, you know, films, original films, not based on existing books and franchises and stuff like that. So yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I can see your point. Yeah,
it just kind of seems like, you know, when you were young, I know things are changing, I don't want to sound like an annoying old man, but like something like Star Wars, that was the big summer movie, or you had, you know, Jurassic Park coming out. Like these were like, it felt like there was like 4 tentpole movies for the kind of the year, and then you had everything kind of sprinkled in between. You would have a Toy Story coming out, you would have a this or a that, whereas like now it seems like it's just like tentpole, and I think there's a bad habit that people are getting into that, like, yeah, franchise movies do take up a huge chunk of like cinemas and screens and people's attention and money, that's okay, I understand that. But people are now getting into the habit where you have these movies, like they'll go pay for the Avengers, and then they'll say, well, see that movie like an Eighth Grade or a Climax or whatever, or something that's kind of doesn't have that sort of, you know, must see at the cinema, must talk about it at the water cooler movie. I'll catch that on Netflix, I'll catch that on Amazon Prime or something like that. Like a lot of these kind of smaller movies, you know, I mentioned something like Apostasy earlier in the year, where it's like a movie about Jehovah's Witnesses. It's, you know, it's visually quite a plain movie because it's complimenting that's what the lifestyle of that is like. But watching that kind of movie with a cinema audience, it feels tense, it feels, you know, you feel a shock in the room. Where you watch that kind of at home where maybe, you know, the lighting isn't quite right, or there's a bit of smudge on your TV, or there's, you know, you're battling with your phone for attention, you're not going to have a great experience. Whereas if you go to the cinema and have the option to see that, like, people should be doing that as well. It just frustrates me. I always worry when it's like, yeah, I'll just catch that kind of on Netflix at some point later. And I know people only have a finite amount of money, but it's just a worrying trend that we've got where it's just like people feel so buzzed by the marketing for all these franchise movies that they only can strictly see these movies, and anything else, it doesn't really matter. The conversation isn't as important because this is dominating everything. It's dominating your workplace, you know, online, social media, everything. And I think that's just, it's gone too far.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm actually looking on Box Office Mojo just now to sort of try and figure out these sort of, when the last time, you know, you had a movie that wasn't related, you know, to a franchise or something. So, I mean, if we're just going back, Lisa, this is just in the US mind. There's actually one very, very, very surprising answer, actually, which I'll be interested to get your take on. But yeah, this year it's Black Panther, 2017 is Last Jedi, before that, Rogue One, Star Wars Force Awakens before that. 2013, it was Hunger Games Catching Fire. Then 2012, Avengers, Harry Potter Deathly Hallows, Toy Story 3. You have to go back to about 2009 for Avatar. And then you had Dark Knight, Spider-Man 3, Pirates, Star Wars, Shrek 2, Lord of the Rings, Spider-Man, Harry Potter. You know, you have to go back to the 90s where it was, you're looking at Private Ryan, Titanic, Independence Day, where you had, you know, original sort of blockbusters sort of coming through. The only one which is a huge surprise is 2014. Apparently the highest grossing film in America that year was American Sniper.
People must love plastic babies.
They must do. I mean, I'm actually just looking at it. Yeah, it took $350 million in the US, which was more than The Hunger Games, Guardians of the Galaxy, Winter Soldier, which is just crazy, actually, to think about. But then, actually, at the same time, it doesn't really surprise me at all. But if you go back, if you then look at worldwide, the film that topped the worldwide box office that year worldwide was Transformers Age of Extinction. So actually you have to go back to 2013 for Frozen for worldwide box office, and Avatar again in 2009 to have sort of original standalone films topping the worldwide box office. So it is that tricky thing that, you know, you want people to see new movies, but then, you know, the accountants at these places will just say, well, look at the numbers, people are still watching, you know, tried and tested franchises and stuff like that. So it's how do you manage to get people to take a chance and watch something new, but it's still the way, still trying to make money and keeping the studios going. It's a difficult one, but I would be happy to see a halt on franchise, on a reliance of cinematic franchises to go into it to room 101. So I'll push the button. Fallen down.
No expense spared on this show.
Absolutely. Spared no expense, just like John Hammond in Jurassic Park. So topic number two is going to be marketing trends. So what marketing trend would you like to see put in room 101?
I feel like I'm complaining about everyone that loves Netflix at this rate, and I love Netflix, but it's the reliance on, you know, that studios seem to be now pushing against home video being released and the quality that they're doing it with. You know, we were kind of talking earlier in the week that I think it was iTunes Canada that started just randomly erasing people's films that they had purchased for, you know, whatever, $20 or whatever on their iTunes, and they were now going to be no longer able to watch it on their TV. Whereas if you have like the DVD, the Blu-ray, you can't take that away. And I think, you know, it definitely is environmentally friendly to kind of go towards just streaming, but it causes an issue that I just don't particularly like. Because take yesterday, for example, you know, it was Sunday night, you know, I'd been away racing and I was just like chilling out. We'd ordered some Japanese food and my girlfriend went, go put something on kind of Netflix. And I suggested some films. She was like, oh, I just want to watch a sort of a romantic comedy, something like that I can watch. And I've been kind of trying to get her to watch Easy A for a little while. And it was like, oh, there's Easy A on Amazon, let's watch that. But then for some reason, the Apple TV was starting to play up a little bit. There wasn't much luck with the Amazon app. So we just had to give up on that and watch something on the home video instead. But it was like, how frustrating that is. Like, you know, these things all happen. A Blu-ray player can break, a TV can break, all these things can happen. But I think if we become a bit too reliant on home like media, like streaming, then we're losing some things that, even simple things like, I have the Duncan Jones films on DVD and Blu-ray, but I don't have Mute on Blu-ray. I feel like I'm missing something from that collection where I can get it out, showcase the art to a friend and go, should we watch this? You know, it's, and it even seems now that there's becoming less and less effort being made to make like bonus features for home media as well. And, you know, I remember that when I first got DVDs, I would watch them like the film, then I watched the audio commentaries, all the documentaries, and that was like par for the course for any home video. And then when it was finally time for me to upgrade to Blu-ray, the reason I did it was like, if I got the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World DVD, it didn't have much in the way of special features, but if I bought the Blu-ray, it would have the documentaries that I would expect from an Edgar Wright release that the other ones had. So I got that, and it just feels like in the past few years, like, it's just becoming lazy with home video. It's like, don't bother with it. Just, you can get it as a stream thing as well. Or if they're releasing a Blu-ray, you know, in particular Disney, the Blu-ray special features are non-existent, or we're not going to bother releasing certain films on Blu-ray, you'll just have to get it on streaming, for example. So, you know, I've got a huge Noah Baumbach collection. I had to get Mistress America when I was in America last year, because for some reason I can get it in Germany, I can get it in America, but I can't get it in the UK. And it just seems like it's become really messy, really cheap, corner cutting. And I know people are down on buying these things, but it needs to be a choice. And I'm feeling like an old man with my Room 101 on choices.
No, I think... No, your preaching's a good word here. I will always be a physical media type of person. I'm the person who's got his DVDs and Blu-rays organized autobiographically in terms of the order I've watched them and the meanings that they've got to me. So I will always be someone who wants to be able to see his collection and, you know, just go, okay, yeah, no, that is, I can see, you know, just by looking at the six sort of shelving units that I've got, this is my life in film. You know, I don't want to look at a screen and go, oh, okay, flick through, these are all the films I've got, because I'm going to forget, unless, you know, you've got a database or spreadsheet on your computer that says everything that you've got. If, you know, if Thanos does his snap and, you know, decides to delete apparently half of the iTunes accounts, are you really going to know that something is missing unless, you know, you've got this spreadsheet and you go, unless you go one day, oh, I really want to watch this film, and suddenly it's no longer there and you're like, why is that no longer there? And stuff like that. But, you know, if someone's moved a DVD on my shelves, I will know. And I will know what's missing, and I will try and find out who's taken it and, you know, hunt them down. So yeah, I'm absolutely all about the physical media. And I think, yeah, I have seen the shift that you're talking about, how there's more of a focus now on the digital and on the streaming, certainly with the big releases these days, Solo and Avengers in the past couple of years. It's, you know, if you've ordered it on digital, you will get it like 1 or 2 weeks in advance of it coming out on Blu-ray. You can watch it on like Sky Cinema, you can pre-order it, and you can watch it 2 weeks before. If you've pre-ordered the Steelbook, you know, you'll get to watch it before that. And yeah, in terms of extras, there is a lot less focus being put on that. I don't know when it happened for audio commentaries. Maybe it was the moment when Robert Downey Jr. did his Tropic Thunder director's commentary, cast commentary, in the character as the person. Maybe that was a point when they sort of jumped the shark and decided they weren't going to do them anymore. But there has been some fantastic audio commentaries on DVDs. The David Fincher ones, for example, on Fight Club and stuff, were just utterly fascinating.
And the documentaries you do too.
Yeah, the sort of deep dive into how these films are made. That is the kind of stuff that I find fascinating and always want to watch them. I did see someone on Twitter saying that the Lee Whannell one on Upgrade, he's done a director's commentary on that, and apparently it's hilarious and also really sort of fascinating and really detailed in terms of the stuff that he talks about on that. So that's one that I'll probably be getting. But I find myself buying less movies on DVD and stuff now, because I just almost find myself without the time to rewatch stuff. These days, there's so much new content out that you find it difficult to keep things. So it's only the sort of films I really, really am passionate about that I will end up buying on Blu-ray and stuff like that. But yeah, no, I mean, I have issues. I mean, I've got Netflix and I love Netflix. It's opened me up to so many new films. But at the same time, you've got that horrible situation where you sort of come home after work and there's two of you going, oh, let's just put on something. All right, what do you want to watch? What are you in the mood for? And then you realise you spent about half an hour looking through this catalogue and then you still haven't chosen anything, where it is if you'd gone next door and picked up a Blu-ray, you know, you'd be halfway through watching a film by now. You know, it's that thing, it's almost, there's too much choice that then makes it much more difficult to put in a decision. So I think I'm with you on that one. So I think we could assign the sort of digital streaming, well, not all digital streaming, but the lack of focus on physical media, that needs to be addressed. So we're going to put the digital only release of films is going into Room 101.
Perfect.
So Topic number three is cinema trend. So this is a trend of something that is happening within cinemas themselves in the cinema exhibition industry. And I probably should point out at this point that I do not actually know what Lee's choices are. He's had the complete reign to choose whatever he wants, and I don't know what he's talking, going to be presenting. So we've had no collusion on this. No collusion, I tell you, no collusion. So what cinema exhibition trend would you like to see put into Room 101?
I think like this is going to echo the one you sort of did earlier in the year, but I really feel very strongly about it, and it seems to be just getting more and more irritating. And it's the lack of diversity in cinema screens due to gimmicks. And, you know, there's no surprise that audience numbers are down going to cinemas. Like, it's just a matter of fact, to be honest. And when I kind of go to the cinema now, why is 3D still an option that's getting rammed down people's throats? Of, right, we've got a 3D screening of Black Panther, we've got a 3D screening of, you know, whatever DC movie's out this week, Wonder Woman or whatever, all these different things, it's 3D. And then you've also got 4DX, and you've got like a cinema with potentially 13 screens, with four screens being taken up with different formats of a movie. And probably the 4DX has maybe got some people that are there for a bit of a laugh, but that's okay. You know, then you've got the kind of 3D screenings, which are probably about a quarter full at best. And then you've got kind of 2D, which is kind of the bog standard. But it's like, you know, the people that seem to be still keeping 3D going are like Disney and some of the big chain, like the big houses, because they're looking for that extra couple bucks that they can put on their tickets and get that money in, get just over, you know, they're not content with a billion. It's got to be a billion and $10 that they got off of kind of 3D screenings. But like, we're all the time, like the amount of times that me and you've said, oh, I went to see this film, it was only showing it one time at one other cinema, upgrade, it's bang on at only one cinema. Like, that could be a film that was getting shown at something else. That I think of all the films that I've seen over the years at multiplexes, and it's getting smaller and smaller. Like, I'm really lucky that I've got, you know, two independent cinemas here to complement the multi-chains, so that when something like the MIA documentary or the Climax movie's out, and if it's not on, well, then I'll go see it at that kind of independent cinema house. But then it was only a few years ago that I would get opportunities to see movies like that at kind of the Cineworlds and, you know, the Odeons, etc. But now it's being kind of squeezed out, and then it's going to independent cinemas, which is great because it allows them to thrive. But it shouldn't be in a situation where the multiplexes are just strictly now, you know, giving people just a diet of kind of a couple of big blockbuster movies, something else, something, a couple of other smaller films on at terrible times during the day that you can't get along to see. It's squeezing out choice. It's depriving people of opportunities. You know, people have unlimited cards, limitless cards. If you give people choices, they will go see these movies as well. And it's cutting off your own nose, really. And it just frustrates me. It really does.
Yeah, no, I think what we've got a situation is, just if you look back at the release of The Predator a couple of weeks ago, it was only released in 3D on its opening night. It was almost billed as sort of previews or something. They've done this with a few films recently where it's only available on 3D on that one night, on the opening night. For somebody, I think it's purely to try and get to boost the takings on the opening night figures, because, I mean, the 3D isn't doing much for these films either. And 4DX, I mean, I completely agree with what you're saying on that, and that it's taking a screening away from somebody else, because these films, these screens have been fitted out with these chairs that can only show 4DX films. So you're tied into screening whatever is being shown in 4DX that week. I mean, I think recently we've had The Nun was apparently a 4DX film. The House with the Clock in the Walls is 4DX, screening 4DX, but also screening in 3D in another screen, and then 2D in another screen as well. So yeah, it's cutting down on the diversity, and I think there's too many films. I don't know who decides, you know, that they want these formats, or if it's Cineworld is paying extra money to have these films converted into this format. But you just have to look at as well at, you know, IMAX as well, sort of coming up. You know, IMAX with the right film can be an incredible experience, but then you've got other films where you question, does it really need that? And I'm looking at Venom coming out next week, which is apparently IMAX. But then you've got a situation where Venom is out on like about the 3rd or 4th of October on IMAX, and then First Man comes out on the 12th on IMAX, and then 2 weeks later, apparently Bohemian Rhapsody is an IMAX release. And you used to be, back in the day, you would be able to have a month where these films are screened at IMAXs, such as like, you know, the BFI IMAX in London. You could have guaranteed that First Man would have been on for a month, 6 weeks, so you could experience it in this thing. But, you know, I'm going down at the end of October and was actually, I really want to see First Man on IMAX. But by the time I'm down, there are no screenings left and it's all going to be Bohemian Rhapsody, which I don't know why it deserves an IMAX screen, apart from maybe if they are recreating the Live Aid moment in Wembley Stadium. But still, you know, there's too much sort of, there's a conveyor belt of films coming out. There's almost too many films coming out, and they're all being fitted with these extra gimmicks and stuff like that, that they're not even being given a chance to breathe in the screens before, you know, they're being kicked out and being replaced by something else. So, yeah, no, I think you know, people were happy for many, many years with 2D films. You know, 3D died once in the sort of 50s and stuff like that. It came around just after the war, when, you know, TV was being invented, people were staying at home, people needed the cinemas were actively seeking a way of getting people back in to the cinemas to watch films. So that was what it did. Eventually, you know, it died a death, but people still kept going to the cinemas. I guess we're at a situation now where, you know, people are staying at home to watch Netflix and stuff like that. They thought 3D might have done it. Again, with the right film, such as Avatar, you know, Avatar was an incredible sort of IMAX 3D experience, but, you know, the films these days, there's just not the same effort anymore. People aren't even filming in 3D anymore. They're just filming in 2D and then converting to 3D, and the results are unilaterally pretty poor. You end up with a darker looking film, murky, and just, yeah. I mean, actually reminds me when I watched Predator on opening night, basically it was being screened and in 3D, but the 3D was off, so it wasn't in 3D. It looked like a 2D film had been split in two, and, you know, it took them about, you know, 5 minutes to actually get this fixed. So yeah, I mean, the effort just isn't there with 3D anymore. And I expect that 4DX and things like that will go the same way, because, I mean, it's also, if you haven't got an unlimited card, really expensive to go and see one of those films. It's about 15, 16 quid, which is just crazy. So I'm happy to put, we put 3D in last time, so I'm happy to take it up a notch and put 4DX into room 101. So you're 3 for 3. Congratulations so far.
Well done. That bribe that you clearly got my bribe in the post.
Absolutely, absolutely. But we'll see what happens next with your plot device. So what cinematic plot device would you like to see the back of?
Yeah, I'm not going to go on. I've gone on about 3 rants in a row, whereas this one, I think it's just a simple kind of plot device that bugs me. And it's the, you know, in particular with science fiction, it's the talk to me like I'm in an idiot remark, where it's like, you know, something's complicated. It's like, oh my God, like, right, okay, slow it down. Talk to me like I'm an idiot. And I see it all the time in science fiction, you know, big blockbuster movies, like, you know, the audience is an idiot, right? Break it all down for me. And I just find it really irritating when that kind of comes up. It's just like, oh my God, here we go again and stuff. It's just like, is writing that bad that we need to still have that kind of trope in it, that, you know, it just bugs me. It's you know, simple as that.
So essentially you would like to see the back of exposition in films. Basil Exposition from Austin Powers, who was there to purely forward the plot and explain how the time travel situation would work and stuff like that.
Yeah, just like, it's just bad exposition. I think sometimes, a lot of the time, it's bad writing as well, that it's, especially when you see in something like Star Trek as well, that it's like someone's just gone given a technobabble speech. Okay, like, break it down for me, make it like, you know, treat me like I'm an idiot. And then they talk and make a kind of couple sentences that make kind of pretty plain English sense. You're like, oh, well, that makes sense. Whereas they could have just made that the sentence at the time. It's just one of these things. It's just an opportunity for people to sneer fake language or technobabble at someone and then go, okay, right, yeah, we get the joke. And it just becomes like a minute wasted of television that is quite limited these days. You know, you're when you've got an hour's television, a minute is a long time, really. And, you know, to have people just basically retry the same conversation twice just seems like an absolute waste of time.
Yeah, no, it can be incredibly sort of frustrating and sort of seeing the, you know, it's sometimes it comes down to the fact that clearly studios or the writers don't have the faith in the audiences to either keep up with the plot, if it's just purely, you know, remembering stuff that had happened, you know, 10, 15 minutes earlier, or whether you have to sort of explain what they're doing in, with psychobabble and stuff like that, and, you know, plot in these sort of scientific devices and how these things work and stuff like that. So, yeah, no, it can be incredibly frustrating. But, you know, sometimes maybe it is needed. It's a tough one. I'm on the fence about this one because sometimes you need it, sometimes you don't. But, yeah, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And put
Thank you.
Bad exposition into room 101. So your fifth and final topic is going to be, we've got cinematic audiences. So what thing that you found that audiences at cinemas, whether it's a specific cinema or just cinema in general, what grinds your gears and what would you like to see cast into room 101?
This is a kind of tricky one because, like, I completely understand where these people are coming from and I support them in what they're doing, but I think that they're kind of, it's frustrating me as well that one of the biggest things for kind of a good few years now has been like, right, we need diversity in films, we need diversity of people behind the camera, we need diversity in front of characters that people can relate to, whether it's something like a Crazy Rich Asians where it's got like a full cast of Asian characters there on the screen that people can go, wow, that person looks like me. And when I find that a lot of these kind of conversations are coming up, people are having these conversations and it seems to be strictly based at blockbuster movies. And I feel that does like a disservice to independent and original cinema where like so many movies are reflecting that diversity. You know, you think of something like A24, which has so many female directors, you know, still, there's still way to go, but they have it. You see so many original films that, you know, all these films like Moonlight that people are looking at, these are films which are original films where I remembered at the time saying it to people like, hey, this film looks like it's going to be pretty big, it's going to be great, it's going to have black representation of gay characters. And, you know, it kind of gets met with, oh, that's okay. But it always seems to be people are always talking about it strictly with blockbuster movies and ignoring that these movies are there, perhaps in original cinema, independent cinemas, perhaps they're that film that's maybe not got the best screen times at your kind of independent cinema. Like, more needs to be done, but we should also be championing these movies that are out there because they are there. There are so many great films that champion, you know, gay characters, black characters, characters of so many mixes of creeds, religions, diversity. It's there in original cinemas, you see it there in festivals, but people are not perhaps going to see those films. And I think sometimes that we get so caught up in fighting a battle for blockbuster movies that we forget that there is a lot of good work there to be showcased. You know, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back or anything like that, but you see something like the 52 Films by Women pledge that's going on just now. Yeah, there needs to be more films by women, but there's a lot out there. And, you know, if you make a little bit of effort, you can watch these films, you can find them. Then you can talk about them, you can showcase them. And that's something that we're doing here in Filibuster, hopefully, that we showcase, you know, a lot of original movies. And I just wish that when people were having this argument that they would also kind of highlight a lot of the good work that's been done. And, you know, sometimes I feel like the work of minority directors and stories and casts are being overlooked by people that, you know, should be championing them. Like, the films are there, add your voice to them, they're there, they're right in front of you, they're maybe just nearby, but we need you to say shout as loud about these films as you are about, let's get these movies, you know, out there in DC or Marvel that have got this kind of representation. It's there, let's do it together.
Yeah, no, I completely understand your point and think that, yeah, more needs to be done to sort of showcase the films that, like you say, are already out there, that are you know, being directed by women, being directed by people of colour and of different sexualities, and highlighting this stuff. But I think I'm not going to put the people who moan about the fact that there's no representation for them on screen, and I'm going to keep them out of the room 101. And basically, I'm going to keep them out of room 101, because if I put them in 101, then they'll never be able to find those films. And so instead, I think that, yeah, like you say, we should be educating people and creating the discussion and stuff like that. And if someone comes on Twitter and says, oh, I can't believe that there's no film starring blah, 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 instead of, you know, having a go at them, just basically saying, well, here is a list of 10 films that have, you know, that have been directed by women that feature, you know, a person of colour in the lead role, and also have prominent roles for the LGBT community and stuff like that. And basically, yeah, sort of work the dialogue that way, and yeah, spread the word about these films and show people that they are out there. If they're not, you know, going to be 2-5 years down the line, you know, waiting to be made, they are already here, and that people just need to broaden their horizons and find them. And if we can be the people who do that for them, then that's the role that we play, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a wise man in making that call there.
Absolutely. So, but still, you've done pretty, pretty well. I think you've got 4 out of 5 there, and that was only, the last one was only on a technicality, and that I was feeling nice and generous, and that these people could, there's another way to teach them, to show them the way in order to do that. So I hope, are you happy with the... Do you think you've been treated fairly in room 101?
I think I've been treated very fairly, yes, sir. You've been a good master here.
Excellent, excellent. So that brings us to the end of this episode of Filibuster here on The Nerd Party. Like you say, The Nerd Party is host to loads of great different podcasts, such as you've got The Nerd Nuptial, Missing Frames, you've got Time Space, Aggressive Negotiations, City Alpha 3, looking at all sorts of nerdy topics, whether it's Harry Potter, which has had a new Fantastic Beasts trailer released today, so I'm sure they'll be talking about that. Likewise, Time and Space will be looking, has recently gotten to a bit of a fizz about the new Jodie Whittaker starring Doctor Who trailer. So there's lots that we're talking about here in The Nerd Party. So check us out at Join Nerd Party on Twitter. And you can catch us on Facebook and also on the nerdparty.com. And Lee, if people would like to talk about films and talk about their room 101 choices with you, where might they be able to find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo. And what about yourself?
Well, they'll be able to find me at champcelluloid. And you can read all my reviews on championshipseller.blogspot.com, where I may or may not be writing about how disgraceful it is that there's now going to be a female-led remake of High Fidelity.
I look forward to reading that.
Exactly. So until next time, it's been a pleasure, and we'll catch you next time, where we'll be discussing, I think, the film house's 40th birthday, and also looking ahead to Lee's trip down to London for the London Film Festival. So until next week, take care, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.